a slight overcrowding. But I think theory of lectures better have a small room that's full than a big room that's half empty, so I'm pleased to see so many people here. Can you tell me if you can't hear me at the back there? Can you hear me all right? Please tell me if you can't. There's a book list going around the room. I'm not sure if there are enough for everybody, but maybe you could try and get a look at it. Everyone, if you could share one, if there aren't enough. I'll produce some more. Anyway, I'm very grateful to you all for coming. And I'm pleased to have the chance to give these lectures, so I hope you'll enjoy them. In my theories, it's much more interesting to give lectures than listen to them, so I hope that some people still stay here as these lectures unfold. Can I just tell you a bit about this book list and explain what I'm trying to do in these lectures? I thought what I try and do, basically, is to provide a lecture course which has had some sort of claim to academic rigor, really. But obviously which isn't oriented directly towards any particular examination. I mean, I do hope that what I have to say has some relevance to most examinations that people here might be doing. And that's the reason I bought a book list, because at least to give some reading background. But I hope the main reason you'll come is just the general interest, really, of these lectures. Now, what I'm going to talk about is basically the impact of modernity on the world. I take it this is essentially what the social sciences are about. Of course, social science is about all types of human society, but as I'll be trying to show in this first lecture, the impact of modernity is something special. We live in the world which is the outcome of the impact of modernity. That is our world. It's a puzzling, difficult world to understand. Modernity, for those of you who don't know the term, is simply a shorthand term for modern industrial civilization. Modernity is simply a shorthand term for the modern industrial order, that kind of social order which emerged in the West from roughly about the 18th century onwards, and which today is in the process of becoming truly global. Is it possible to shut that door at some point there? Just be a bit, if you could, it would be good anyway. that kind of civilization, industrial civilization, modern civilization, which after all emerged in only one small pocket of the world, Western Europe, which previously was relatively retarded compared to other major civilizations in the world, I think you have to say, such as Chinese civilization, somehow has impressed its way of life upon the world as a whole. One of the main themes of what I have to say in these lectures is the impact of globalization. Modern industrial society is a globalizing society. And as I'll be trying to show, there's a sort of fantastic intensification of globalization over the past relatively short period of the existence of modernity, the past 40 or 50 years. I want to say quite a lot about what it means to live in a global society. We are the first generation, I think, to live in something close to a global order. We are the first generation to inhabit what you could call the global age. This is not an age, as we all know, which has produced unified humanity. It hasn't produced what Marx anticipated. I'm going to talk about Marx a bit in the first couple of lectures. It's produced a fractured world, divided world, stratified world, but nevertheless a world which is still dominated by the impact of the expansion of Western industrial systems, which now have produced a kind of global cosmopolitan society, for better or for worse, we're all in this world. Let me just tell you, if I might, a little bit about the books on this book list, so give you some help in sorting your way through them in case anyone does decide to look at any of them. Yeah, the first batch, the first four books here, are all books relevant to what the global age is, the impact of globalization. The most useful book, I think, probably is the last one down here, Martin Albrow, The Global Age. You might not have seen this book yet, it only recently came out. But I think it's a very good guide. It's not that long, it's a good guide to what's going on both in the world, but also in the attempts of social scientists to understand how we should confront this world. One of the themes of what I have to say in these lectures is that we don't live in a postmodern world, or at least that the concept of postmodernity is not a useful one to understand the sort of world which we've arrived at. The concept of a global age is a much better notion, I think, to understand that world. Something to say about that in subsequent lectures. The next batch of books down here, that is the sort of 7 or 8 books in the bottom paragraph, are all introductory books on Marx. I'll be giving this lecture, next lecture, and maybe a bit the following lecture, to try to look at one of the most amazing phenomena, truly, of the past 150 years, or 100 less than that, 100 years or so, which is the rise of Marxism as a force which has shaped history. I mean, Marx was not your ordinary social scientist. He wasn't some guy who stands around giving lectures at the LSE. Marx was someone who wanted to change the world, and Marx did change the world. 20th century is stamped by the impact of Marxism, intellectually and politically. But since 1989, as everyone here will be conscious, Marxism has collapsed. Why? What happened? Why was this sudden reversal? What accounts for the crumbling of Marxism? What accounts for the disintegration of Eastern European communism? These are moot questions, but they're fundamental questions of our time. You can't understand what happened to Marxism, I think, without first of all understanding what Marxism was and is, because in my mind it is not a completely dead force, and I'll be saying why in these lectures. Among useful readings here, probably the most useful general book is the one next to bottom, David McClellan, The Thought of Marx. It's a good, unbiased introduction to reading Marx. I mean, you can't, I think, still be a citizen of the 20th century world and not have read Marx and about Marx. A lot of the literature on Marx, as you'll know, is very slanted or takes a particular partisan view, but I think McClellan's is a good sort of straightforward introduction. If you want something more difficult on Marx, Jon Elster's book in the middle, Making Sense of Marx, is one of the best sort of general comprehensive interpretations of Marx and Marxism. You could contrast that with G.A. Cohen, the one just above there, Marx's Interpretation of History, to see that you can make many different Marxes, because Elster's Marx is a rational choice Marx, believe it or not. Cohen's Marx is a functionalist Marx. They're very different interpretations, but they're both sort of classical books in their own way. Now, everybody, I think, in the social sciences should have looked at Marx's early writings. I'll be saying a bit about them today because they are a luminous spot in the history of Western intellectual culture. I'll be describing their influence, which is quite extraordinary, really, the history of that. Marx's early writings contain the notion of alienation, and they produce a very different Marx, either from Elster's Marx or from Cohen's Marx. There are many Marxists who have lived in the 20th century. Anyone know what this noise is in the background? High technology always gives you problems, honestly. Over the page, there should be a gap between Wimster and Lash and Anderson. The books above Wimster and Lash are all books about Max Weber. What I'm going to do in the first part of these lectures is contrast two of the dominant interpretations of modernity. One is that of Marx, the other is that of Max Weber. Max Weber is a German thinker like Marx. Max Weber produced a very, very different interpretation of the trajectory of modernity from Marx. I'll be arguing that although each writer has some relevance, each interpretation also now is becoming obsolete. We have to sort out what's worthwhile and what isn't in the works of these authors. Now Weber's interpretation of modernity was much more somber than that of Marx. Weber did not see the possibility of human emancipation in the way in which Marx did. And with the collapse of communism, many people in the social sciences, as it were, have switched from Marx to Weber. because history doesn't seem to have the shape that Marx thought that it would. Is this switch correct? I don't think so, for reasons I'll be saying. All of the next batch of books concern roughly the next sort of six or so lectures after the first four or so, in which I'll be trying to trace out the impact of globalization. Why has communism collapsed? Well, it's something to do with globalization, with the intensifying of globalization. It's something to do with new information technologies. It's something to do with shifts in the nature of global institutions, which we're all experiencing. Next batch of books are all relevant to this debate. It's a debate which some part centers around the notion of postmodernism, but certainly not completely so. Most useful books in that batch in the middle there, well, on Max Weber, sorry, the most useful books are The Readers. Second one down is probably still the best book, Girth and Mills from Max Weber. That's a collection of readings. Second one down from the top, collection of readings. It's dated now, but it's still probably the best selection. If you want to read about Max Weber, Dirk Kaisler, the third one down there, Max Weber, An Introduction to His Life and Work, is a good short account of life. Sorry, this mic misses according to where you are in the room. There's a blank spot somewhere around about here. Anyway, I'll be talking a bit about Marx and Weber as personalities. And it's quite interesting, the relationship between the emotional lives of authors and the works they produce. They were very different personalities, Marx and Weber. And this book gives you a certain amount on Weber's life and his torturous problems, because he was indeed a tortured person in a way in which Marx wasn't, really. The next batch, I'll be talking about the rise of nationalism, the impact of nationalism in modern politics and the formation of modern nation states. Ernest Gellner, who is such a famous figure at the LSE, is probably also the most famous theorist of nationalism. You'll find in the middle there Gellner's book, Nations and Nationalism, still one of the best books really written about the interpretation of nationalism, even though I have to say I do not agree with it, or at least I do not agree with the theory in it. If you want an introduction to the debate about what modernity is now, what postmodernity has done to it, whether there should be a notion of postmodernity, the best book is David Harvey, which is five books up from the bottom of the top section, as it were, The Condition of Postmodernity. David Harvey, The Condition of Postmodernity. Subsequently, I'll be talking about the impact of globalization producing apparently more fractured, divided, and stratified world. Some of the readings towards the end of this book list are relevant to that. I'll be talking about what the impact of modern social change has been upon the divisions between rich and poor, and how we can address this issue, if at all, of the apparent increasing polarization of global society. You see in this country increasing economic inequality, but this seems to be also a global trend, in spite of the successful economic development of certain formerly so-called third world economies. The best general sort of introduction to class and stratification is Rosemary Crompton, three books down in the section up from the bottom. Rosemary Crompton, Class and Stratification. Finally, I'll be looking at what the impact of all these changes is upon our personal, emotional, and sexual lives. If I can put it this way, a sort of main theme of these lectures, is that there are two sets of changes going on in the world. We're living in a much more global order, an intensification of global systems, including the global economy, but not limited to that. At the same time, these changes work themselves out in our local and personal lives. Globalization is not just about the large institutions. Globalization is about a tremendous sea change in how we live, which has its impact on most aspects of our personal identity. I think there's a tremendous transformation of our emotional lives, which is going along with a global transformation. These are global revolutions, global changes, and there are many adaptations to them, but I'll be spending some time looking at the more local consequences, because we live those consequences, I think, in our lives. And we don't really know what the outcome will be. If I can put it this way, modernity was seen by Marx as an experiment which, as human beings, we could control. It has turned out to be an experiment which we don't still know whether we can control. Modernity is a gigantic experiment with the future of humanity. This applies on our personal lives, and it applies to the collective future of the planet. We just don't know how devastating or how emancipatory the global impact of modernity will turn out to be. This is not what Marx anticipated. There are reasons for this. Those reasons, once you understand them, I think allow you to understand why contemporary intellectual debates are as they are, why they are now different and radically different from those which led up to at least the late 70s and perhaps to the very threshold of 1989. Let me begin by sketching a backdrop to the development of modernity and its impact on the world. And in so doing, since this is part of modernity, I'll try and use this gadget here. I was hoping for a kind of low-tech blackboard, but there's no chalk in the LSE, apparently, so I have to use this high-tech device. You have to tell me whether the thing works. When you look at the history of humanity, you might think it looks like a progressive line, that human beings started from relatively small-scale societies, and that the history of the evolution of human beings is a progressive growth in technology, a progressive growth in the level of social change, and an accumulation in the material resources, science and technology which human beings use. This is not the case. You might think, naively, in other words, that history looks like this. You can see that, just as a rising straight line. It does not look like that. It looks much more interesting than that. Human beings have existed in recognizable form probably for about 100,000 years, although there is some dispute about this. For most of this time, however, human history has looked more like this, a very gently rising line, if it's rising at all. Going on for... Sorry. Honestly, technological society. For over 90% of the history of human beings on this earth, people have lived in small-scale societies where there wasn't really all that much change. Somewhere around about 6,000 years ago, you get a radical disjunction in human history, and things look like this in terms of a growth curve, an increase in dynamism, social, technological, and political change. This is a period dominated by the rise of traditional civilizations, shouldn't this be a bit brighter? Why is it so dull? Anybody know? Can you actually read that, anybody? Good, okay. Traditional civilizations such as those of what is now in the Middle East, of Rome, China, and later on Mesoamerica, these were fundamentally agrarian civilizations in which you find the rise of certain distinctive characteristics. The rise of the state, these are the first state-based societies. The rise of intensified technological development, and the rise of war. Now, war did exist, I think most anthropologists now agree, although there was always some dispute about it, in smaller types of human society. But organized war is a product of what has come to be called civilization. Civilization, the rise of civilization 6,000 years ago, produced many forms of art. It produced writing. Civilization is convergent with the invention of writing. The reason for this is that writing is a medium of power. Writing did not emerge as what you're doing with it here, or what I'm struggling vainly to do on this high-tech gadget, a way of telling stories. Writing emerged as a way of keeping tabs on people and on goods. It was a means of recording. It emerged, as the anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss shows, I think, as a form of power. Writing was behind the rise of the administrative power of the state. The administrative power of the state was also backed by military power. You see the rise of organized armies, military machines, with the development of early civilizations. However, this period of history is still one of relatively slow change, much faster than in earlier periods of human history. But when you get to the 18th century, or something around 17th, the 18th centuries in Western Europe, you get a radically different picture. Over a period which is very, very tiny in human history, we're talking, say, 300 years here, you get an incredible acceleration of change. Who says modernity says change? Modernity is easily the most dynamic form of society in history. So this graph shoots up, really, almost vertically, I would say, over a period of some 200 years with the advent of modern industrial societies or modern industrial civilization. To me, this is very important because, to me anyway, and I should stress this is also controversial, but to me, modernity is not like any other previous civilization. Modernity is not just an extension of traditional civilizations, it is something different. That's why I think we have to treat it as a global experiment. Modernity has placed us on a sort of social, economic, and political spaceship, and we don't know where this spaceship is really going. Several things happen to the dynamism introduced by modernity. Modernity, first of all, produces change which is much faster than in any previous civilization, much faster. Consider, you know, the way we live now, the end of the 20th century. You buy a computer, even the purchaser knows the computer is obsolete at the moment you buy it. An extraordinary level of technological change. But technological change is only one type of change, which affects us all. We've been accustomed to living in a society dominated by change, but the world was never like this, really, before the advent of modernity. It was not like this for most of human history or for most people. It is like this for all of us now. The speed of change, therefore, becomes much greater. The scope of change becomes much greater because modernity, from its beginnings, is a globalizing civilization. I mean, the Chinese Empire could have conquered a lot of the world, but the Chinese imperial rulers at a certain time, crudely put, decided they did not want to. They did not want to expand across the world. They stopped the ships which had begun to explore the world well before the Western ships did. It was not a civilization which spread across the world. Modernity, modern industrial civilization, has this amazing restlessness. It is an expansionary civilization. So it's one of the main features of it which Marx drew attention to, and he was quite right. It is not a civilization which can stand still. It is not a civilization which can stand still. This is something very strange, historically very strange. And it's a society which is very difficult to live in. Very difficult to live in a world where nothing stands still. Because you can't use the past, at least so much, as a way of orienting yourself to the future. All of these things are just as true of our individual lives as they are of collective systems. Third, modernity increases vastly the intensity of change. First, speed. Second, scope. Third, intensity. Intensity means the depth of change. In traditional civilizations, there was a lot of change among the elite in the cities, but this change did not affect most people living in the villages, whose lives were probably not all that much changed for generations, even thousands of years in traditional China, for example. In our society, change reaches down into our everyday lives. It is much more intensified. Nothing escapes it, really. That's why I think the personal angle on these things is just as important as the wider social angle. Now, it's quite easy to give a preliminary account of how, or to give a more empirical account of how the dynamism of modernity contrasts with traditional civilizations. And let me just give you two or three instances. In no traditional civilization, no matter how advanced, so far as we know, did more than 10% of the population not work in agriculture. At least 90%, and usually more than 90% of the population, even the most splendid traditional civilizations, like Rome or China, worked in agriculture. Contrast this with modern industrial societies today, where you have an amazing situation, I think. I'm not sure anyone really sort of taken in the extraordinary significance of it. Only 2% of the population produces far more than any of us can eat. Only 2% of the population in the UK works in agriculture. This historically completely unprecedented situation. And this 2% produces so much food that you have to pay them not to produce. That's a good thing in the case of beef, I might say, but in other areas you also have to pay them not to produce. A remarkable turnaround. An industrial society is the first non-agrarian society in history, is modernity and our lives. You can see it all around you. You know, the world in which we live is a constructed world. It's not a world of nature. As I'll be saying in these lectures later on, nature has disappeared. There is no longer nature, I think, in an important sense, which I'll come to later. Technology organizes our lives in a way in which it never ever did previously. Another example, secondly, a look at the impact of cities. Rome was a great city. Shanghai, classical China, was a great city. These, as far as I know, are the only two traditional cities which probably had populations of above 1 million at a certain point in the history. Most traditional cities were very small. London, for a lot of its history, had no more than 30 to 40,000 inhabitants, and this was true of most capital cities in Europe until about even as early as the 17th century. Consider the situation with the development of modernity, where all this is reversed. In modern societies, for example, in the United States, if you look at the eastern seaboard, going from Washington to New York to Boston, this is almost a completely built-up area. It is, if you like, a city. It's an urban agglomeration. It has some 40 million people living there. Look at the area from Tokyo to Osaka and surrounding areas, probably 30 million people there. Nothing of this kind ever known previously in history. And this is something which is continuing. If you know your United Nations statistics, you'll know that only about 6 or 7 years ago, we passed the threshold from a world in which most people live outside of cities to a world in which most people live in cities. More than 50% of the world's population now live in cities, and this is an accelerating process. In about 20 years' time, there'll only be about 2 cities in the industrialized world itself which will figure in the top 20 in terms of numbers. All the other big cities will be in the developing or so-called third world countries. What happened in Europe as a process of industrial transition from a rural-based society to an urban-based society is now truly a global process, and that process again is accelerating globally, at least outside of the industrialized countries themselves. Third, and these are just illustrations, the third illustration, consider the role of communications, which I'll be emphasizing here is very fundamental thinking about what societies are like. For all of their history, the traditional civilizations had no way of communication apart from very local ones, which didn't involve you going somewhere. To communicate with somebody, you had to take the message. You could do it sometimes relatively fast on horseback, for example, or by ship, but you had to physically go to take the message. This means that many strange things happen. For example, wars were fought, which went on a year after a peace treaty had been concluded. No one knew the peace treaty had been concluded because it took so long for the news to travel from one area to another. This happened right up until the 18th century in Europe itself. There are similar examples of that, and something like that actually happened in the American War of Independence with the Battle of Orleans. which I believe was fought after the peace treaty was actually concluded, but no one knew about it, so they still went on with the battle. Around about 1850, Henry Morse, the inventor of the electric telegraph, introduced a truly revolutionary thing, which was instantaneous transformation, or almost instantaneous transformation of information from one point to another. Once this happens, modernity accelerates dramatically. I think you can say, contrary to what some of the things you read around at the moment, the modern industrial civilization has always been an information society. It was associated, after all, with the industrialization of printing. Printing played a key role in the rise of the modern state. You can say that writing played a key role in the rise of traditional civilizations. Printing played a key role in the early emergence of industrialism and the modern state. But the process of industrialization and the intensification of state power accelerate massively once electric and electronic communication has been invented. The Morse code, Henry Morse, transmitted this message, "What hath God wrought?" The first electronically transmitted message. Modernity has long been an electronic society as well as an information society, and this is crucial to its global spread. Even more crucial now, if you consider the rise of 24-hour money markets, one of the most significant economic changes of the past 20 or 30 years, the rise of 24-hour dealings in money across the world. These dealings affect the value of the pound or whatever it is in your bank account or pocket immediately. This is only possible because of global satellite communication, instantaneous global communication, coupled to the computerization of information. This is not quite as new as it sounds because it is very much an extension of earlier technological changes, but it certainly changes our lives in a massive way. Now, when you look behind to look at the early origins of the dynamic nature of modern industrial civilization, its restless, erratic, growing character, I think most people would trace it to two great revolutions which happened in the late 18th century, or which were concentrated in the late 18th century, the two great revolutions, they are known. At risk of life and limb, I'll try and use this gadget again here. Oh, I see this little screen actually that tells you where it is. You can see my hand on the screen. Can you see this rude gesture? You can. You can. Well. Well, the first of these was industrial revolution, and the second was political revolution. Both of these were unknown in history previously. When you think of the industrial revolution, you tend to think of little kids pulling around carts in mines and spinning jennies and all that kind of stuff that appears in school history books. The Industrial Revolution really wasn't like that. I mean, it was a technological revolution, of course, but it was a revolution in ways of life. It was the revolution which underlay the changes that I've just mentioned, really, or many of them. The Industrial Revolution was a transition from an agrarian-based rural society based on low communications technology to a predominantly urban, non-agrarian society based upon an intensifying of communication systems. This transition, therefore, I would stress again, is not one which simply was confined to the 18th century. You might think, well, the Industrial Revolution happened in the 18th century. Not so. The Industrial Revolution is with us. The Industrial Revolution is our way of life. We live in a world of permanent technological revolution. Technological revolution, it doesn't determine all the changes which affect our lives, but it's central to them. The Industrial Revolution has become a global revolution in the late 20th century. It is still going on. We don't know what its consequences truly will be. This is the revolutionary nature of modernity, is to some extent bound up with the economic forces unleashed by industrialism. Marx was the first great theorist to see this and trace out its implications. The second political revolution, by this you mean, above all, I think the French Revolution of 1989, French Revolution of 1789, there was another one in 1789. You should realize how distinctive this was. You can couple it a bit to the earlier American Revolution in 1776 as perhaps the first genuinely modern revolution. Now, revolutions, political revolutions, seem to be unknown in previous periods of history. You could possibly say the English Revolution of a century earlier was a sort of political revolution, but it was much more traditional in form than the American and French revolutions were. What was distinctive about them? Well, some historians draw a quite useful distinction between what they call rebellions on the one hand and revolutions on the other. A rebellion, you find many rebellions in feudal society and in early forms of human society. These are often inspired by religion. They do sometimes envisage the coming of a new world, but this is a religiously inspired vision. Or else they were peasant rebellions, often against paying of taxes. The first case, religious rebellions, you have a vision of a new world, but it's not usually a world on this earth. It's a world in an ethereal future. In the case of peasant rebellions, most peasant rebellions were against particular people. They wanted to get rid of a bad king. They wanted to get rid of an unpleasant local seigneur. Modern revolution is different from either of these types of rebellion. It is secular, primarily secular. I mean, there still are religious revolutions, of course. But modern political revolution of the 1776-1789 type is predominantly secular. And it is not a rebellion in the sense in which it does not just aim at changing personnel. It aims at changing, like the light bulb joke about Marxist says, the system. Revolution, you probably don't know this joke, I can see, won't bother to tell it, but how many Marxists does it take to change a light bulb is the joke. Won't tell you the punchline, they're too boring, these light bulb jokes. Anyway, political revolution, well, you can't change the bulb, you've got to change the system, that's the point of the joke. So. Political revolution was about changing the system. Well, what did it introduce? Well, what it introduced was the notion of democracy. Don't fall for the idea that democracy is 2,000 years old. It isn't. Modern mass democracy is a product of modernity. Mass democracy is a product of the French and American revolutions. Now, again, I think everyone can see, really, that the Freudian slip I made, 1789 to 1989, is not really a slip at all, because the 20th century and the 19th century, they're revolutionary centuries in the sense in which democracy is an all-conquering concept. You don't necessarily need a revolution to introduce democracy, although there were revolutions in 1789 and in 1989. Democracy as a concept, mass democracy, mass participation, the fact that we have a chance in some sense to run our own lives, is a dominant fact of the 20th century. And you should stress it was not always so. The notion of democracy disappeared after the classical age of Greece. It was reinvented in a different form, sense of mass democracy. And democracy was extremely unpopular until the 20th century. Most elites rejected it, was not available to women, was not available to people who did not own property. It was not the concept it has since become. The 20th century is the century of the generalization of democracy in the same sense as it is the century of the generalization of industrial production and high technology. The two seem to go together. And so it seemed to the first people who tried to think about the origins of modernity. What is the connection between these two revolutions? I hope everyone can see this question is a live question in the late 20th century. Can, for example, you have liberal democracy without capitalism? Can you have capitalism without liberal democracy? It's an open question, but a fundamental one. When we look at what's happened in Russia after 1989, we see a somewhat different path of development from what's happened in China. In the one case, glasnost, in other words, political democracy plus perestroika, in other words, the attempt to introduce capitalist markets. In China, economic reform without, so far anyway, political reform. Is the Chinese way in some sense more effective? Does a site like Singapore, for example, show us that Western societies place too much premium on individualism? I mean, personally, I do not think so, but I'll be coming to these issues at the end of the course because they're very, very live issues, but they emerge from the early period of modernity. Now, Karl Marx was the first great theorist of modernity, and let me just begin to sketch in the backdrop to Marx's life and work. Marx lived at the time at which modernity was making its first impact. In other words, the industrial and French revolutions in particular were fresh in people's minds in Europe. Marx lived from... Oh, I'm mastering this thing now. 1818 to 1883. So his life spanned the period at which the first impact of the industrial and political great revolutions was being felt. Let me just tell you very briefly a bit about Marx's life, because his life mapped out this impact, I think. Marx was born in the more liberal sector of Germany, which was not yet Germany. Germany, where Marx was born, was not a unified state. It was a collection of different principalities. Marx was born in the liberal southwest, where the dominant political trends looked towards France and the French Revolution. Very significant fact about world history and about the impact of Marxism, for reasons I'll explain later, also relevant to the ideas of Max Weber, was that German unification was not brought about by the more liberal sectors of the country. As every historian here will know, German unification was led by Prussia. Prussia was an authoritarian, bureaucratic, military state. It subjugated the more liberal aspirations of the Southwest and elsewhere, and it subjugated Marx, because even in the early part of his life, Marx had contact with a Prussian system of government which forced him out of the country. As a young man, Marx had many radical ideas, and the authorities did not like these ideas. The authorities, especially in the northern part of the country, of what was to become the country. Marx therefore left Germany and moved to France. Now, I mention this because it's very significant for reasons I'll come on to. First, Germany, but as a young man, he spent quite a short period in Paris, but this period stamped Marx's life, and therefore, I can assure you, stamped the whole of 200 years of history. Some very crucial thing happened here, which I'll describe. Marx wasn't very popular in Paris either, and therefore he came to this well-known land of tolerance, Britain, and he spent the rest of his life in the UK. Working down the road from here in the reading room of the British Museum. When I was a student, we used to scrabble, try and get Marx's desk, because it seemed to be known which desk was Marx's desk. You could never get it because there's always some white-haired gent sitting there. And he was always there before everyone else. He was the kind of fleshy sort of inheritor of Marx in some sense. Now, Marx therefore spent the rest of his life in this country, and what became Marxism was stamped by this differential experience. In each of these national environments, Marx drew upon different intellectual traditions. He built these into an unstable, fragile, and never completed whole. Marx is one of these guys, I'm sure I can see some in the audience here, who never finished their books. Marx never finished, I think, a book that he set out to write. All of his books were drafts for subsequent books, including his masterwork Capital, which was also never finished. So Marxism was built on a pretty unstable and often to some extent contradictory set of intellectual resources. More about this in a second, because it's really important. It's really interesting, I think, actually. But that's one reason why you get so many different versions of Marxism. In Germany, Marx was primarily a philosopher, and he was influenced above all by Hegel, by the philosopher Hegel. Hegel was a conservative philosopher, but Hegel did this crucial thing, and I'd ask you to keep this in mind for anyone who stays with these lectures. Hegel thought that history had a shape. Hegel thought that history had a form. Marx took over this belief. It is a belief which we are possibly on the point of abandoning in late modernity. It's no longer clear that Marx and Hegel were right about this. Hegel certainly thought that history had a form. But Hegel thought you could only discern this form retrospectively. You could only see the shape of history when it had happened. As his famous thing, based on classical illusion, the owl of Minerva only flies at dusk. The owl of Minerva only flies at dusk. You can only understand history at its closing, at a closing of a particular period, you can discern its shape. Now, Marx rejected this. Marx thought, yes, history has a shape, but we can control that future shape. That is the crucial division between Marx and Hegel, and it was crucial to Western intellectual culture. Marx thought, if Hegel is right, if we as human beings make history, why shouldn't we control our history in the future? Why shouldn't we determine its shape? Hegel thought you couldn't consciously determine the shape of history. Marx thought precisely that we could and must in the future. Marx took from Hegel, basic notion, came into Marxism, the idea of the dialectic, still an interesting idea. I think still, you know, a pretty fertile idea. Dialectic simply means that history is made by the fusion of opposites. Dialectics comes from argument in classical Greece. I provide a point of view, you contest that point of view. Out of this clash of opinions comes a new opinion and perhaps a consensual agreement. That's what dialectics means. Marx thought that history was like that. History is a history of clash, of struggle, of division, but out of such struggle you can get new forms of synthesis, and indeed socialism and communism were supposed to be one of these. Now, in Paris, Marx became a political thinker, probably for the first time, even though he was a radical in Germany. And he came into contact with the early emergence of communism and socialism as ideas in French political theory. These were new ideas at the time. At that time, people used the terms communism and socialism as interchangeable. Why did they do so? Well, because the early theorists of communism and socialism were doing what Tony Blair is trying to do now. Tony Blair is more of a communist than a socialist, you can say, because both of these terms have origins in the idea of the community or of the social. The early French thinkers confronting the first development of modern industrial capitalism said, here is a society which is too individualistic. We can't base a society upon greed and competition. We must base a rational society on communication and cooperation. That's what communism was. Communism has its origins in the term commune. Commune means the local community. Socialism has origins in the word society. It also means an emphasis upon the social connection, social cohesion, rather than individualism and competition. Marx took over many of these ideas. One of the main thinkers he had this kind of problematic relationship to was the thinker Proudhon, and he wrote a number of critiques of Proudhon, but he picked up the idea of communism and socialism. So you see what's happening here. Marxism emerged as, first of all, a theory of history, grafted onto this afterwards, as it were, it emerges a theory of communism and socialism, and then on to that, later on, Marx became a political economist, or an economist, if you like, simply. And in Britain, He was influenced by Adam Smith and by Ricardo. And he sought to produce a critique of political economy. Marx's masterwork, Capital, is subtitled A Critique of Political Economy. Marx thought he could use the ideas drawn from German philosophy and from French socialism to criticize economics, because he thought economic theory was based upon the presumption of individualism. It produced a society in which the pursuit of individual profit does not yield social good. Social good has to be created by other means, Marx thought. This, therefore, eventually produced Marxism, and Marx himself never really, I think, integrated each of these strands of thought. Very briefly, before we conclude today, let me just say a bit about Marx's main writings that you should at least know about. Something very interesting here to start with. The time when he's in Paris, 1844, Marx wrote a series of manuscripts which were never published. These came to be called the 1844 manuscripts, sometimes also called the Paris manuscripts. And sometimes also called the economic and philosophical manuscripts, different names for the same thing. I'll say a bit about these in a subsequent lecture because they're completely riveting, because Marx's early writings were not published until well into the 20th century. Marx's early writings, the 1844 manuscripts, are where he talks about alienation. But these were not published until Marxism was well established. They became, especially in the 1960s, a basis for Marxist counter-revolution in Eastern Europe. Many of the revolutionary attempts within Eastern Europe to confront official Marxism were inspired by the discovery of the writings of the young Marx. Here Marx appeared less as an economist and more as a humanist. More about that in a subsequent lecture, because it's really important in world history, I think. In 1848, the year of revolutions, or one of them, Marx produced the Communist Manifesto. A spectre is haunting Europe, he said. That spectre is communism. Well, this was true until 1989. It was true in the Cold War. The spectre of communism defined post-war history. He was right about this, but he wasn't right ultimately. Still worth looking at, Communist Manifesto. Among many other writings, should mention Marx's masterwork, Capital. First came out, if I remember, 1867, Vol. 1. Only one volume of Capital was published in Marx's lifetime, Capital Volume 1. There are three volumes of Capital. The second two volumes were published by Marx's long-term collaborator, if I'm still on this page of this infernal machine here, Friedrich Engels. Something very important here, thought to leave you with. Friedrich Engels was the St. Paul to Marx. Engels it was who popularized Marxism. Marx was unknown, relatively speaking, in his own lifetime. He did not become the center of a major movement. It was Engels' own writings, Engels' interpretation of Marx, which created Marxism, and Engels' version of Marx, as we'll see if I get time in a subsequent lecture, was not at all necessarily that of Marx himself. Well, let me just thank you for coming, and I very much look forward to seeing at least some of you next week, so please hang in there.